It's the Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon on the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Ian and Dan are here with me. That song is called Jailbreak by Thin Lizzy. That's a word my next guest never wanted to hear because for many, many years he was the warden of Missouri State Penitentiary, a historic building that opened in the first half of the 19th century and didn't close until 10 years ago when Missouri built a new penitentiary about 7 miles down the river in Jefferson City. Well, last weekend, my wife and daughter and I went out to Jeff City because they now do tours of the old Missouri State Penitentiary. And I've always kind of been fascinated with prisons. We've been to Alcatraz. We've been to a couple of others on tours. If Shawshank Redemption is on cable and I come across it, I must watch from that point until the end.
I do, too. I have to watch it.
Same thing with Escape from Alcatraz, the Clint Eastwood movie, and on and on and on. And we went there, and I wasn't sure what the two-hour tour was going to entail, but I knew that it was going to be good as soon as our tour guide introduced himself, because he used to be the warden of the place. And nobody knows more about the prison than the warden. His name is Mike Gruce, and he joins us now. Hi, Mike. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Thank you again for a terrific tour last weekend. How many years were you at Missouri State Penitentiary?
I actually was employed there in 1963, and then I was transferred out to a medium security prison for about 10 years, and then I came back. So I spent around 20 there, a little over 20.
How many of those years were you the warden of the place?
I became warden in 1990 and was replaced in late 95.
All right. Now, I mentioned that this place opened in the first half of the 19th century. Tell us a little bit about when it opened and what that prison was like in that time.
Well, it opened in 1936.
1836.
I'm sorry. 1836. And when I tell people that, they immediately think of the Wild West days, but the Wild West days were in the 1880s. This is the 1830s. And just coincidentally, the week that we received our first inmate was the same week that Davy Crockett and Jim Bowie were killed at the Alamo.
Wow. Hmm. So America was expanding west and needed a big prison, and this was a really big prison, right? At one point, the biggest in the country?
That's correct. Across the United States, prisons were built kind of at the same rate that the country was being settled from east to west. And most people realized that when the settlement of the country reached Missouri, it sort of stopped because everything else was kind of the Great Plains or the mountains. And as a result of that, our prison was 1836, and Kansas didn't build their state prison until 1870s.
So for like three decades or so, Missouri State Penitentiary was the only one west of the Mississippi. And as people traveled west, what if somebody were arrested for a crime in Kansas or what eventually became Colorado or Nebraska or other places west of here as the frontier expanded? Were they brought back to Jeff City?
Yeah, they didn't have much choice in those days when they were settling the west. They had a lot more important things on their mind, obviously, than building a jail or a prison. So what they did is actually transported that person all the way back to Jefferson City. We had actually several thousand inmates that had come from the West being brought back. That's what made us actually the largest prison in the United States.
Now, when you were the prison warden during those years, was there trouble there? Because I remember there was a time in Missouri State Penitentiary history where we went through a period kind of like what happened at Attica in New York and in other prisons around the country, where there were prison riots seemingly cropping up all the time. Did that happen in your prison?
It did happen in our prison. Kind of the bigger picture of that is those riots you're referring to, Attica and New Mexico and Ohio and ours, all of those happened in the late 50s, early 60s, which coincidentally kind of lined up with the civil rights movement on the street. People were getting more rights, and prisoners wanted more rights, and they were resistant to authority, basically, in our prisons. And in many cases, that ended up in riots. In our case, we had a riot in 1954 in which four inmates were killed during that riot by other inmates and one by the staff as we retook the prison.
Now, when we talk about a riot, What is that like inside a prison when you're the guy in charge? I know you weren't there in 1954, but you probably had to face situations where the threat was always there. What's that like for the authority figures who hear that something's going on in some cell block? Tell me the story of how a riot begins and how you respond to it.
Well, I guess I can use as an example our 54 riot. What happened there, we had a unit that had three officers working it at the time, and an inmate overpowered one of the officers and got a key, and then he opened a couple cells, and then him and his buddies overpowered the other two officers, and at that point they began opening all the cells in this lockdown unit, and the riot was pretty much on. What happens is usually your group of inmates then will scatter across the prison. Fires are always a big part of that. They start setting things on fire, and then as they can, they just take over other buildings and expand it as much as they can.
And in 1954, you said four people died. Were they shot by officers or killed in a fire, or how'd they die?
Only one was shot by officers. The other four were killed by other inmates. A couple of them were informants, and I really don't know the story on the other couple, but there were four that were killed by other inmates.
Speaking of inmates, who are some of the famous people who once lived inside the walls of Missouri State Penitentiary?
Well, we've had Sonny Liston. We've had Pretty Boy Floyd, of course, a gangster from the 20s. We've had James Earl Ray, who most people recall as the person who killed Martin Luther King Jr.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, as James Earl Ray escaped from us and was on escape status, he had been gone, I believe, a year and a day when he killed Martin Luther King Jr.
What was he in Missouri for?
My recollection is that he robbed, like, a grocery store.
So armed robbery got him in there, and then how did he get out?
Well, he's told two or three stories on that, but the actual story is the fact that we had a bakery inside the prison, and we produced baked goods that we hauled out every morning to some satellite prisons near Jefferson City. And what he did is apparently watch the tower officer or the gate officer who searched that truck every day and noticed some flaw in that he wasn't searching the truck in some particular area. And he was able to hide in that truck and just ride out.
You also mentioned that Sonny Liston was an inmate there, a world heavyweight champion at one point in the pre-Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay days. I guess he was still called Cassius Clay in those days. Did Liston learn how to box in the Missouri State Penitentiary?
That's the story we've always heard, and then that was verified by the fact that in one of the first interviews he gave after he became a heavyweight champion, he attributed the fact that he became a boxer to his time in the Missouri State Prison. In fact, as in the early years when I went to work there in 68, I met an inmate who worked in our recreation program who all the other officers told me, this is the guy that trained Sonny Liston, and I had a chance to visit with that guy a time or two.
Now, on the tour, which, again, was terrific, and if you want to find out information about going on one of these tours out in Jeff City, Missouri Penn Tours.com is the website. I'm happy to plug it because Mike and his colleagues there do a really good job with a building that was kind of abandoned by the state 10 years ago when they closed it down. And this group and the Jefferson City Convention and Visitors Bureau kind of had to convince the state and the city as well to put some money into it. They haven't fixed the place up. It's still rusting and still not in great condition, but the cell doors are still there. And in fact, on the tour, Mike tells you, whatever you do, don't go in here and close one of these doors because we're not going to be able to open that up. And it's not going to be easy for us to get somebody in here who can get you out. So don't close the doors. Don't touch the doors, he says. But at the end of the tour, Mike, you take us to the gas chamber. That's the last stop on the tour. Tell my listeners a little bit about the history of the gas chamber at the penitentiary.
Well, in the state of Missouri, all executions occurred by hanging. Back in the county, the crime took place. For example, it's just like in the Western movies where they took them out behind the jail or the courthouse and they hanged them. But those became such a spectator event that people were coming into these towns from miles away to observe these hangings, and it ended up kind of a street fair atmosphere. At that point, in by the 1940s, the legislature intervened and appropriated us money and directed us to build a gas chamber. And the gas chamber was completed in the mid-40s, and it was used until 1989. And during that period of time, we executed 40 people in that building.
Well, that would coincide with the time period when you were the warden there. Does that mean that you were in there and actually had to pull the switch to release the cyanide gas?
No, I did not. Actually, by the time I became warden, was on into the 1990s.
Oh, I see.
So we had gone to lethal injection by that time and moved that task down to Potosi, Missouri, actually, then.
Okay. When they did it with the cyanide gas, and you show us on the tour what the chamber is like, how did they get that deadly gas out of there once that person had died?
Well, that was, of course, the most dangerous part of the whole process. Once the person appeared to be deceased, what they did is all the correction staff were removed from the area, except for one person. Of course, he would be wearing a gas mask, and he opens some floor valves and turns on an exhaust fan that would draw air from the floor up through the chamber, and then there's actually a 60-foot pipe on top of the building that the gas exhausts through. And they would let those fans run for up to maybe 45 minutes to make sure that all the gas was out of the chamber.
And then any bird that flew over.
That's exactly right.
Not just birds, but the gas chamber is actually near one of the outer walls. You probably had to clear that street and maybe part of the nearby community to make sure that people weren't affected by that, right?
Well, we went to such lengths that not only did we clear our area inside, but we took the officer out of the tower that's nearest there. And since we were pumping that gas up into the air anyway fairly high, the nearest tower is on about that same level. So we evacuated that tower, and then the Jefferson City Police Department would come in and check behind the wall and just, as you said, where the nearest houses are to make sure that no one was nearby.
Did they have anybody, any inmate that was in there that was in the gas chamber, and he went down, and you thought, for sure, this guy's dead, and you did all of that, evacuated everything, and went in, and he's still alive?
That, to my knowledge, never happened.
Okay.
Cyanide gas is such a toxic substance
that I've
never observed one of those, of course, but I've been told that a couple of deep breaths of that and there is no surviving.
In fact, it was so much of a problem with all the gas that they had to get out of there that when you told the story that when the coroner went in there, he actually had to hit the prisoner in the chest to make him expel the gas from his lungs, right?
That's true. The inmate, of course, had inhaled the gas. His lungs were full of that gas, and at least to some degree. And just as a safety precaution, the doctor, one of the first things they did was to hit this person in the chest to make sure that gas was expelled so it could dissipate. If we didn't do that and there was gas in there, of course, when the local coroner picked up the body, we could certainly have had a catastrophe.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when we went on the tour with you, I noticed when we walked into the gas chamber and could see the whole apparatus in there that there are actually two chairs in the gas chamber. I mean, there's the witness area around the outside, and that's all shielded and sealed off. But inside the actual gas chamber, there are two chairs, not one. Was there ever a double execution?
Yeah, four times in the using of the chamber, they executed two people together. What that was is those people were fall partners on the same cases. They were apparently, arrested, tried, convicted, sentenced, and sentenced to execution together, and rather than somebody make a decision who goes first, they simply put two chairs in there and executed them both together. So historically, that's been done four times.
Was one of those the Greenlease kidnapping case from the 50s?
That was Hetty and Hall were their names, Bonnie Hetty and Carl Austin Hall. They kidnapped a little six-year-old boy up in Kansas City and killed him and actually buried him in her flower bed up in St. Joseph, Missouri. And then they left there, and they went to St. Louis, where I believe it's the Coral Motel.
Coral Court, yeah.
Coral Court.
And they were caught at the Coral Court?
That's correct.
And so when it was time for them to go, they went together?
That's correct.
All right. This is fascinating. Talking with Mike Gruce, former warden of the Missouri State Penitentiary, is now one of the people who gives a tour of the place. You can find out information on going out to Jeff City and taking the tour yourself at MissouriPenTours.com. One of the other things you talked about at length was the fact that the penitentiary wasn't just a prison. It was actually a factory. These inmates were turned into factory labor for many, many decades, right?
That's correct. When you have big populations, it's even more important that you have something for them to do to keep them occupied. And what they had done, starting off in the 1800s, they had provided different work opportunities for them. In our case, in the early years, They made such things as shoes. They made rope. They made harness. They made things that the pioneers needed when they settled the West. And that was the first types of industries that we had. In later years, we moved to producing they make office furniture, school desk. Of course, everyone or most people who come on tour, the first thing they think about is license plates when you come to the prison.
Mm-hmm.
And all Missouri license plates that exist were made by an inmate. Even the ones on people's cars today were made by an inmate.
So they're still making them at the current penitentiary?
No, they're making them at the new one down the road.
This is
the one that's 7 miles from the old
one. Right, at the new one, yeah.
Yes.
Was there ever any thought to the competitive nature of having a factory that essentially had free labor compared to businesses that wanted to be in the manufacturing business that had to actually pay people and give them benefits and all of that stuff?
That was a real problem in the early years of the prison. Eventually, the federal government, though, passed what's called the Hawes-Cooper Act, and that prohibits prisons from... It prohibits several things, but two of which, it prohibits prisons from selling their goods that they know are going to cross the Missouri state line, in our case, or selling, in some cases, goods to individuals. So what happened, the prison actually retooled about that time and started producing stuff that we could sell to the public schools and cities and state government.
Interesting. When you were the inmate, could you walk through the yard? When you were the warden, I'm sorry, not when you were never the inmate, but when you were the warden of the place, could you walk through the yard?
Oh, yeah. The warden usually tours his prison typically about every day, if you can. So I would say I was on the average out around the yards and all 4 days a week, probably.
With armed guards?
No. No, none of the officers inside the prison were armed. The only armed staff we had were in the towers.
So did you just know the inmates, or did you know which inmates to stay away from? What was your relationship with these guys?
Well, over a period of time, you get to know a lot of them, considering the fact that if you're a long-term employee, you're there 5 days a week, and they're there those same 5 days.
Yep.
So you get to know a lot of them really well. And really, the group you get to know the best are the troublemakers. The guy who's just the guy who behaves himself, wants to do his time and go home. You have minimal contact with that sort of guy. The guy who's in trouble all the time, not listening to the officers, you're violating the rules, those people you have a lot more contact with.
Like being the assistant principal of a middle school. It's the troublemaking kids who are in your office all the time.
It's exactly that way. You've got a finger on the pulse of it.
And you put them in the hole then, huh?
Yeah,
in
the hole. I want to talk about the hole because you took us down to, well, I called it the hole. You called it administrative segregation. I guess that was the official technical term for it. Describe for my listeners what that is.
Well, in current days, it's an area where inmates spend most of their time in their cell as opposed to those inmates that come out and work during the day. But in the early years of the prison, what it was an area that they put, they only had, in our case at the old prison there, they only had 8 cells dedicated to it. So what they did is put the worst of the worst there, the most dangerous people in the prison that they thought they simply could not safely let out to walk around with the rest of the inmates. They put in those cells, and they were in the basement of a building. There was no light down there. Of course, the prison was built, the first inmate arrived 42 years before Edison even invented a light bulb.
Right.
But they were put in those cells down there in this dark basement. There was a solid door so that they had to be in darkness. They couldn't even get any light from the officer's lantern or candle or whatever he used. And then they were fed in that cell. They had a chamber pot, a bucket of water in that cell. It was a pretty miserable existence.
You took us down there and put about a third of the group in the cell that I was in, and you put the others in the other 2 cells or 3 cells nearby. And then you told us you were going to turn out the lights, and one woman in our group gasped. And then she said, and I thought she was going to say, wait, I'm claustrophobic, or I don't think I can handle the darkness. The first thing she said, Mike, was, there are no spiders in here, are they? And I will tell you, when you turned off that light, I did get a sense of what it must be like to just be separated from the world.
Yeah, when you're put in that, and that's one of the reasons we do that, to give you a real feel for what it was like, to a minimal degree, of course, for those guys. But when we have people like yourself that go in those cells and we kill the light and then we slam that solid door as we're doing it, it really gives you the ominous feeling that, am I really going to get back out of here?
Yeah. I mentioned in introducing you all of these prison movies, including The Shawshank Redemption and Escape from Alcatraz and others. As a person who worked in the penitentiary for all those years, what do you think when you see those movies? Did they get it right?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't watch those movies.
You don't?
I have seen Shawshank Redemption. I have not seen the others that you mentioned. And to some degree, they get it right. On the other hand, they sensationalize things as you would expect movies to do.
Yeah.
A lot of times. So it's a pretty good mix. You can watch those, or I can watch those and see things that I think, well, this is a real life thing. This is based on history. This is correct. And then as soon as I'm thinking that way, 10 minutes later, they go off on some tangent that makes no sense at all.
Last question for you. Have you had people come on these tours and say, you know, my brother was in here?
Well, not only have we had that, and the answer is yes, but not only have we had that, but we've had a lot of ex-offenders who did time at the prison who
come
back for tours.
They came
come
on
back
a tour?
To bring their wives or their children or something for a tour.
Yeah, to take the kids. Here's where Daddy spent several years not being a part of society.
Well, that's actually one of the first things they usually ask me is which buildings we're going in on the tour, and if it happens to be one in which they live, they always want to know if they can take their wife or children or whoever to the cell to show them their cell.
Yeah, and by the way, speaking of the cells that you showed us were, at least in recent times, a two-person cell, but at one point, six guys were in there. Like in the 19th century, when you have no heat, no air conditioning, no electricity, can you imagine what that must be like to be crowded in there with five other guys, and you get outside a little bit of the day, but all night long, you know, one guy in that room snoring, that could lead to big problems.
I'm sure that added to the miserable atmosphere of it, and it would have been, doing time in the early years was hard. There's just no question about it.
Yeah. I'm sure it's not that easy today. The website is Missouri Pen Tours, P-E-N, no, not double N, but just MissouriPenTours.com. I would urge you to go out, take this tour. Mike leads it sometimes. There are other volunteers and employees of the tour group that do that out there in Jefferson City. I thought it was absolutely terrific, and I'm really glad you came on and told some of the stories here today, Mike.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed chatting with you and your listeners today.
Thank you so much. Mike Gruse, former warden of Missouri State Penitentiary, here on the Big 550 KTRS.